Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in African American Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I am your host, Adam McNeil. Today on the podcast, I get the amazing opportunity to chat with my friend, Dr. Nicholas Guyett, author of Bind Us Apart, How Enlightened Americans Invented Racial Segregation, published in 2016. During my conversation with Nick, we discussed not only Bind Us Apart, we chop it up about the 2020 U.S. presidential election, the many kerfuffles surrounding the 1619 Project, and what it means for Nick to write about the lives and experiences of Black and Indigenous people in the early American Republic period. I hope and pray y'all enjoy the conversation. Welcome to the podcast, Nick Guyett. How are you doing today?
Hey, Adam. I'm so glad we finally got the chance to do this. I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing great. You know, it's for those who don't know, it is Election Day 2020 here in the United States. And I'm talking to my brother from across the pond, Nick Guyett from Cambridge University. And so I'm feeling good. I'm feeling good on Tuesday, November 3rd, 2020.
It's weird, isn't it? Like, just to think about the fact that whoever listens to this, they're going to know, I think, what the outcome of this election is. And me and you right now, we are completely in the dark. We're left alone with our hopes.
Exactly. And I think that there's, yeah, I like how you said that. That actually puts a interesting a spin on the moment that we're at, and it really sets the scene up fairly well. Especially because, you know, we're talking about American elections, but we're also talking about the founding of the nation, right? We have this thing in the air called originalism, you know, in terms of the Supreme Court and some of these historians, right? You know, we'll get to that. There's a whole lot to talk about that. But sure. First to begin, let's talk about this amazing book called Bind Us Apart. What is the origin story of this book?
I love the way you frame this question, Adam. Like, the origin story, it's kind of like a superhero reference, you know, like Bind Us Apart began as a normal child and then maybe its parents were taken away and it became this kind of superhero or supervillain. Like, you have a very nice way of asking the question when you say origin story. I was writing this previous book, my first book, which is called Providence and the Invention of the United States, which is basically a book about how Americans, principally but not entirely white Americans, came to think that God liked the United States more than every other nation. So it's kind of this big kooky book that kind of takes on that question and tries to kind of give a history and a spin to, you know, what became known as Manifest Destiny. One of the things I do in the second half of the book is I try and look at how white Americans approach the persistence and the kind of survival of African American and Native American people in the early Republic. And what kind of jumped out at me was this bizarre process by which mostly white Americans argued that Black people and Native Americans could go someplace else, that actually they might go off to the West or they might go to Africa or the Caribbean and found these glorious societies there where they could be, you know, Native Indigenous Republicans or they could be Black Republicans. And they'd be just like white Americans, but not in the U.S. So this struck me as a kind of bizarre process and a kind of strange dynamic. And I got to thinking about it a bit more and wanted to write about it. So back in 2011, I had an article in the Journal of American History where I went into this at some length and basically tried to set up white projects for displacing and for removing Black people and Native Americans in the same frame. And I should say, Adam, that we often don't think about Native American removal and African colonization. So these two schemes for racial removal, we don't think about them in the same frame. And there are a whole bunch of different reasons for that. Like, one of them is that actually removal happened for Native Americans. And for the most part, it didn't happen for African Americans. But historians have been kind of reluctant to put them together. So anyway, in the article, I put them together and argued that we should think about these as parallel schemes. And what made them really interesting to me is that they were, generally speaking, schemes that were not endorsed by the most diehard white racists or slaveholders, or sort of pro-slavery Southerners. They were actually endorsed by the kind of people that we would now describe as liberal. So we're talking here about white moderates, people that believe slavery is a bad idea, support gradual emancipation, and so on. Those guys were really driving both of these ideas, Indian removal and also African colonization. So that's kind of where it began with my previous book. And then, yeah, I did this article in 2011 for the JAH. And then I thought it deserved a whole book. So the book actually came out a while ago in 2016. So you probably remember it better than I do, but I'm going to do my best today to pretend like I'm on top of my brief, okay?
Hey, and it's an interesting way that we can connect the 2016 election to the 2020 election too, right? Because we're present to historians, right? We're presentists. We're always looking at the present to help us inform us about the past that we write about. So, you know, objectivity, right? For the win.
There you go.
Yeah, good old methods class. And so, you know, one of the things that, you know, I love about New Books in African American Studies is that I get to talk to my favorite historians about not only books, but also kind of like the meta, right? How do these historians and these scholars and these writers and these thinkers write their books? So for me, Nick, can you talk to us about, you know, overall, specifically to Bind Us Apart and in general, your writing process, right? Tell us about your writing process and what that looks like. Paint us the picture.
Yeah, well, I mean, you'll appreciate this. I think everyone in the history biz will appreciate that the biggest challenge being a historian in terms of writing is figuring out how to make peace with the fact that you don't know enough, right? Like, you never know enough. Like, whenever you pick up your pen or you start typing, you always know that there's more that you could read. So I think that, like a lot of us, I struggle with that, to getting to the point where I'm actually willing to, you know, do the trade-off, right? It's like, well, this book or this article has to appear before the end of time. I could carry on reading until the end of time. Therefore, I need to kind of call an arbitrary end to the reading and start with the writing. So I struggle with that a bit. But actually, the like writing, like just sort of putting the words on the page, that's not so much of a problem for me. The bigger problem is writing too much. So the first draft of Bind Us Apart was about 200,000 words, and the final draft is about 120,000. So my brilliant editor is like, hey, we love your first draft. Here's where you need to lose those 80,000 words.
Goodness so, gracious, you know,
in some ways, yeah, there's like a whole book cut out of the book. But anyone who's read Bind Us Apart will not miss the 80,000 words that I cut out. Like, they might have wanted me to cut some more out. So actually, that's sort of a big part of my writing process. I tend to write a bit long. So figuring out how to get rid of the, you know, the filler, the stuff you don't really need, that's the bigger challenge for me than writing the words in the first place.
Wow. See, that's some good stuff. So I'm actually going to spin this a little bit differently. So, you know, I mentioned, you know, painting the picture of us. Are you the type of person, right? Hey, you know, I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I'll talk about mine too, right? So that you know that this is, you know, that this is a back and forth, right? What does the scene look like in terms of, are you a nighttime writer? Are you a early morning, you know, got your cup of coffee, you know, all that kind of stuff? What does the, like, you know, the setup look like too, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, so I have now written another book, which we might talk a bit about later on, but it's still in draft. And I tell you, Adam, I made exactly the same mistake. So I wrote 200,000 words nearly. The book is supposed to be 120,000 words. No, I'm not even kidding. So I've like learned nothing, right? So I have this book manuscript now, which I need to take another 80,000 words out of before the publisher will accept it. And they are totally right. Again, nobody wants like the director's cut of this new book. Anyway, I should say that like that book, this one I've been writing this year, I didn't have really a word on a page until the start of January. So from January through the beginning of May, I wrote a chapter a week. And to begin with, I wrote a chapter a week in my office. So if I needed, like, I'd start on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. If it wasn't done on Thursday, Friday, I would stay until it was done. Tried not to work the weekend. And then when we went into lockdown, which over here in the UK was the middle of March, I moved to the shed at the end of my garden, which I can tell you, Adam, is as glamorous as it sounds. It has power, but doesn't really have anything else. It doesn't have light heating or, I mean, it's kind of a crap hole. So I was in there then for another 2 months. And, you know, like in March, like it kind of still gets dark fairly early. So Thursday or Friday night, I'd be out there till like 9 or 10 or 11 o'clock at night. And my family are in the house. They're like, what is the crazy man doing now? But it was important to me to get the chapter done per week because I really felt like I needed the manuscript. So I don't recommend anyone writes this way. This is a bit of therapy for me talking to you about it. But when I have to and I really need to, I can crank it out. But I don't know. How does it work for you? Do you find it easy?
Whew, that's a great question. Yeah, for me, I'm at the point now where a month or two ago, I interviewed Dr. Jessica Marie Johnson on the podcast for her new book, Wicked Flesh. And I tweeted about this earlier this week or late last week, where I was literally just thinking about writing. And you know how sometimes you look at the mountain and then your knees start to you know, quiver because like the sheer amount of like, damn it, I got to get all the way up there. Me, what's actually helped so freaking much. And Dr. Johnson, if you're listening, thank you, because she mentioned writing and she thinks in 250 word chunks. And
right,
I'm like, well, shit. Okay. 250 words. That is effectively what a long paragraph, effectively, I guess. I'm trying to think.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm thinking, can I do a paragraph 6 days a week and I take off for the Sabbath on Sunday? You damn right I can, right? And here's the thing. I'm at this point now where there's always something to write, whether it's writing for a fellowship application or revising. For me, it just helps me to think. I'm like, because the thing is, my thing is, I can see the vision. I can write down the writing, like what is due over the next 6 months. But the minutia of getting to, like, effectively, I don't want to have to stay up a whole day to be able to write something. I need to be able to hit it where I'm doing 250 to 500 words contributing to it. And it doesn't have to be on one thing. It could be on multiple things in one day. So it's effectively trying to get there. And so it's still a work in progress, but Lord knows I've seen myself change from the beginning of the year to now. And to go even further, you're talking about, you know, the shutdown. When I remember that's probably a conversation with myself just or with people, and they were talking about, you know, working from home. I was like, how the hell do y'all work from home? How do y'all do it? I don't know how. I am a coffee shop. I am a, you know, I'm a coffee shop drink, coffee shop writer. I am a library writer. I am everywhere but my damn house writer, right? But then quarantine happened. Like, I had no, you know, my butt started to get tired because I was sitting on these bad chairs in the house. And, you know, and so I didn't have a desk. I didn't have an office chair. I didn't have, you know, bookshelves in my room. And so I had to literally on the fly, because my room is small, I had to effectively 70% of my room is work. Like, desk, three bookshelves. And, you know, it's not necessarily optimum for a full life, but I know for this year, it's been conducive. And so it's just been nice seeing myself change. And it's a process, of course, but looking, you know, 10 months earlier or 11 months earlier now, it's been a process. And so thank you for asking, you know, about therapy.
You know what? I tell you what comes out of what you just said, Adam, to me is, well, I mean, I should have said this earlier. So when you're a writer, whether you're a historian or any kind of writer, and someone invites you to talk about your process, you immediately move into this kind of bubble of preciousness, right? Where you're like, let me tell you about my process. Actually, it's like everything else. Stuff is all deeply gendered. I'm sure that, like, you know, your position in the profession or whatever else influences this a lot. Also, just the stage of life you're at, right? So, I mean, I have two daughters. One is about to be 12, the other's about to be 14. I probably couldn't have gone away with, like, sitting at the shed at the end of my garden, like, until 11 o'clock at night, were it not for the fact that my wife is taking on the parenting responsibility, which is basically just means ignoring my kids. But, you know, someone has to ignore them actively, right? That's how parenting works. So she's doing that. I wouldn't have been able to do that maybe 5 or 10 years ago. And again, like, you talk about the position in your career, I was really fortunate to have leave this past year. There are a whole bunch of people that don't have leave, that are trying to start in the business, who are effectively trying to make this magic happen without all of the kind of privileges and the perks that I had. So speaking personally as someone who's got a nice job and is a bit further on in the profession, my heart goes out to you, and I'm absolutely, like, in awe and admiration of those people who necessarily have to kind of cram this stuff in. And whether it's 250 words a day, or, I mean, you spoke about Jessica Marie Johnson. I mean, she's like a master stylist. Like, she is a total craftsperson, just in terms of, like, the way that she writes. I mean, her stuff is awesome. But I mean, for those of us who are just trying to get, like, anything on the page, I just think, yeah, some of us are really fortunate to enjoy the fact that we get, like, a leave year. And for others, you have to try and make your writing fit the circumstances you're in. And I think that's so tough. So I have such a lot of admiration for people that can make it work, whatever the circumstances, right?
Indeed. Indeed. And, you know, we're at the point now where, you know, we're entering this, I don't know if you want to call it second, third, fourth, or how, whatever stage we're in of this quarantine, and definitely not quarantine. Very few people even do that anymore. But this, you know, shelter in place kind of situation in our countries.
Yeah. Yep.
And now it's like, you know, I think we're reaching the point of stamina. Like, do we have the stamina? Because, and I see this being near, living near my college campus and going to pick up food from places around, and literally seeing, like, the fatigue on, and not necessarily that you can see the fatigue on people's faces, but through the, through their actions, you're seeing fatigue of just, like, and this is something where I've had to really, you know, not wag my fingers at people and actually think about myself. 10 years ago, when I had, when I started college, could I have just been that responsible to not do anything? I'm just being completely, like, this is as objective as I can ever get in life. Could I have reasonably expected myself? Or I was a resident assistant, so I had a, I cared for freshmen and sophomore young students, 18, 19, 20 year olds. Could I have expected myself, or could I have expected them, to adhere to all of these rules? Not to say the rules are not important and they shouldn't be there, but also the understanding of the human nature of it, right? Being cooped up in, you know, for X amount of time. So shouldn't be out here just going wild and just doing all that. Definitely not absolving that. Make sure that's on, you know, that's on the record. But I also have to be at least somewhat understanding about that too. You know, and I'm sure, you know, you're teaching right now, and I'm sure you kind of probably see that in some of the students that are probably interspersed through the community, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that you're right. I mean, we kind of, so first, like, you feel incredible compassion and solidarity with everyone, right? And I mean, there are sort of layers of good fortune, I guess. I mean, if you have a job in the business, and maybe even if you're in grad school and you're kind of secure in your position or whatever else, at least getting your PhD done, you have another few years of funding. I mean, you know, that's a better place to be in than be out in the workforce right now, where, you know, it's tough and there's not a lot of hope on the horizon. But I think as a teacher, or as someone who has an academic job, the really nice thing always about what we do is that we have the research and we have the teaching, and they are obviously deeply connected. But they're also really different activities. You know, one of them is a bit more solitary. You may have a writing group, but it's still kind of more solitary. The other is so kind of community focused. And I mean, I felt, coming back off leave this past year, I've really wanted to invest time in my students. I mean, I hope I would always do it, right? But I've really gone the extra mile, and I'm going the extra mile right now, because you can just see these human beings that you're teaching, that they need this. Like, they need to feel engaged with, they need to feel valued, they need to feel as if there's a purpose to what you're doing. And you're going to make teaching on Zoom work. You know, you're going to make this remote stuff work. You're just going to have to pour your heart and soul into it. And for me, that's it's hugely rewarding. I mean, it's a sort of like privilege as well as being a kind of responsibility of the job. But it's something else. Like, if you ever get a job in the business, they're so hard to get, but you're just so lucky to have one. And yeah, right now it's a fascinating place to be in terms of thinking about what you can do to help your students.
And one of the things that I'm sure your students appreciate is how much you talk about the U.S. founders. I'm sure that they appreciate that. And
yeah.
And you have contributed really to, you know, our understanding about the founding era and also this thing called racial segregation. And so, you know, the U.S. founders have had thousands, maybe even millions of books probably written about them over the course of history. Going back to Bind Us Apart, and even I also noticed that you had a chapter, I think, in the African American colonization book through University Press of Florida. So you can, you know, weave, mm-hmm. you know, any thoughts from that too. But why do you think no one really made a substantive connection between the founding era and the Enlightenment and the origins of U.S. segregation?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, there are a bunch of reasons, right? I mean, I think that one of them is that we tend to see segregation as a post-bellum, you know, like story following the collapse of Reconstruction. So to put it really crudely, white people in the South, and again, we tend to think, or at least this is the way that a lot of popular historians think, of black people as being a Southern rather than a Northern phenomenon. So black people are located in the South. Slavery means that you don't need a system of segregation. Because within slavery, there are all kinds of intimacies and all kinds of proximities, which are kind of licensed or made necessary by the institution of slavery. But then the moment slavery is abolished, suddenly the law and social practice needs to come in and enforce this separation, you know, to serve white supremacy and to protect kind of, you know, whatever white sensitivities and anxieties. That's the way the story usually gets told. So what you get then is you get slavery and segregation. Like, segregation is the sequel to slavery, right? So Jim Crow mm-hmm. is the thing that happens in U.S. history when slavery is done. Now, I mean, that's always struck me as being, I mean, there's more than a grain of truth to that if you want to try and think about this demographically or in terms of the total size of the African-American population. But it's always struck me as being flawed in two ways. I mean, one of them is obviously there's a significant population of African-Americans in the northern states. Some of them in the antebellum period who are coming up from the upper South where they've been manumitted or emancipated, but most who are born free. So we have this very large free black population. So we ought to be thinking about the citizenship claims, the kind of calls on all men are created equal that those guys are making from the get-go. But the other reason that I think ignoring segregation in the founding period is a really bad idea is that there's this kind of popular misconception that the reason slavery isn't abolished during the American Revolution or just after the American Revolution is that slaveholders are desperate to make money from enslaved people. Now, that's not a lie. That's true, but it's not the whole truth. And if you go back and you look at, say, the state of slavery in places like North Carolina and particularly Virginia and Maryland, maybe Virginia is the best example, you have a whole lot of slaveholders, enslavers in the 1780s and the 1790s, who recognize that economically speaking, the crops that they have produced with enslaved labor are not as successful as they used to be, and who feel the contradiction between holding human beings in bondage and these ideals that the United States has just signed up to. And actually, I mean, I call them in Bind Us Apart anti-slavery slaveholders, you know, which is a paradox, right? But it's mm-hmm. also intended to be a bit ironic. I mean, these are guys claiming to be against slavery who still hold enslaved people. But the reason they tell you, Adam, that they will not or cannot free their slaves is they say enslaved people can't live next to white people after slavery. So in other words, it will be impossible for them. I mean, Thomas Jefferson says it in Notes on the State of Virginia.
Exactly. You know,
there'll be these kind of 10,000 recollections of harm suffered or whatever. There may be the real differences of nature as well, although Jefferson kind of finesses the race thing. But it's basically like we can't live alongside these people after we free them. So we should free them, but we can't live alongside them. So that to me was the kind of like, as much as thinking about the free black presence in the North, trying to figure out how important that motive was for perpetuating slavery, a kind of social squeamishness about a mixed race society after emancipation. That to me is why we need to plug segregation back into the founding moment, because this is where these schemes for removing black people or colonizing black people take root. And, you know, we'll get into this, but it seems to me significant that Thomas Jefferson, maybe close to the most important or next to most important of the founding fathers, is a colonizationist from an early part of his career until the day he dies. Now, that should matter in American history more than it does. Why do we choose to look past it? Well, we could get into that.
And we will. And we will. And you know, you brought up when you brought up Notes on the State of Virginia, I literally was like, notes. And like, so I already know, like, we may be 1,000+, you know, multi-thousand miles away, but we are like well connected. Like, it's like we're married. Yep, it's like you're finishing my sentence. It's great. I really appreciate it. You know, because Notes on the State of Virginia, I remember, I don't remember the first time I read it, but I remember one of my first recollections from reading it was, first of all, how actually magnificent it actually was, right? Take, you know, and I don't say that lightly, but just thinking about how black folks have talked back to Jefferson since 1776, right? And just thinking about Jefferson in Black American memory. And so I'm thinking about, Annette Gordon Reed's work. I think Mia Bay has written some about it as well. But just thinking about in the Black intellectual tradition, you know, talking back to Jefferson in a way, you know, going back to someone like Banneker or Walker as well. Sure. And so, you know, and also just thinking, like you said, talking about colonization and also how the Notes, if I'm not mistaken, was the only actual like book that he actually got published. I don't know if I got and so just thinking about that tome as being such a manifestation and also a central part of even your work as well, thinking about segregation, especially with scientific racism and such like that too, and it's also why I was so happy reading your book, just reading, because I read it for my comprehensive exams, which I took in African American history about a month ago, and reading it was just like, oh yeah, I got it. You know, reading this, I got to make this interview happen because we're at the particular point in our history where I think it's important to read a book like yours. In general, I think people should have read it in 2016, and they probably would have made hopefully better decisions. But hopefully people have matured. Hopefully people have matured over the course of these last 4 years. And so
it's kind of you to say that. But I mean, I just want to say, Adam, I mean, like, this is sort of bracing conversation, right? I mean, for a lot of people in America, because one wants to imagine that the founding is the beginning of a process of extending rights, extending citizenship, extending all men are created equal to everyone. So in other words, that you can kind of trace a straight line, and better still, a straight line on the graph that's kind of going up and up and up, but gradually includes more of the American population. So if you want, there's a kind of, let's call it like a continuity to America's moral epiphany. And if you can locate the moral epiphany in either the Declaration of Independence or in the Constitution, and then you can see it kind of unfolding and getting kind of ever more glorious as it gets larger and larger and larger, well, that's a really comforting thought. And also it kind of unites American history in a way that could bring African Americans, white Americans, possibly other hyphenated Americans within the same community. The problem with colonization is it supposes that white people understand that slavery is wrong. So they get the kind of moral argument against slavery, but they still want to exclude black people. And I think it's that kind of crime against our desire for a more morally unified American history that a lot of us who've written on this stuff are kind of, we're fighting against the perception that we are, you know, we're like putting graffiti, we're putting tags on the founders, right? Like we should be respecting them. And instead we're suggesting that these are guys that could imagine slavery was wrong, but could also think that black exclusion was right. And I think that that is a boulder, or like a stone that you have to keep pushing up the hill in American history, because people want the story to be a happier one than it was.
Exactly. And to even refer back to what you had mentioned before about, I think you said the specific term was anti-slavery slaveholder. I think that was.
Yeah.
That, you know, to me goes to the point of just like how people just want the founders to be so palatable, right? Even just like Hamilton, right? Just thinking about him as a, almost as like a verb now in a way, because of how Hamilton, the musical or whatever, has taken on its own, you know, life. And, you know, everyone's looking for that anti-slavery founder or that that abolitionist founder. It was like,
Did you see that piece, Adam, in the JR this summer by Jason Young, The Fear of a Black Planet Towards a Diasporic History of the Early Republic? Do you remember that? It came out in like June or July, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, so what was great about that was the way, you know, Jason was like, okay, so Hamilton is awesome in a way because it effectively inverts our assumptions about race and the founding. But also it inserts black people in the founding of the US in a way, again, that actually gives a kind of sucker to this narrative that there was always space for black people at the founding, right? It was like eventually they found that space. And that Hamilton is the kind of ultimate sign that that space was always there for them to find. And, you know, I mean, Jason Young in the article is like, there are other black trajectories, there are other chronologies. You could think about the African diaspora, you could think about black nationalism, you could think about these other ways of navigating not just black identity but black belonging, which don't place the be all and end all of a black future with the birth of the United States. So I mean, I think again, Hamilton, between things like Hamilton and 1619, what you've seen, I think, in the course of the past few years is an incredible focus on the founding moment from all of these different political perspectives, which I think make for an incredibly rewarding like national conversation, but also make for a difficult time for people. I mean, there's a reason that Hamilton is a whole lot more popular with white liberals than 1619. Let's just put it that way.
Alrighty. All right, you're I see some flames. I see some flames over there. Uh-oh, you're burning down some houses over there.
I don't want to upset anyone on election day. You know that. I don't want to upset anyone.
Hey, look, Nick, you're definitely you're hinting at something that's really important, because and I love how you connected 1619 to 1619 Project from Nicole Hannah-Jones, a phenomenal journalist at the Times, to to Hamilton, right? Because at the end of the day, we're in a moment of almost like, you know, I was born in 1992, and I remember hearing these stories about like Eric Foner on, you know, CNN and with Liz Cheney and all these, you know, the culture wars of the late 80s and early 90s. And so just thinking about what 30, effectively almost around 30 years later, this might be, you know, maybe not on the same level, but it's in the atmosphere. Like it's near, this kind of moment.
I
was gonna say, the 1776 commission from Trump, you know, makes me also think, right, you know, Gordon Wood, and you know, who the hell knew what a world socialist website was before 1619 Project? Lord knows I didn't. You know, and so it's just, you know, a freaking situation. I'm like the interesting bedfellows, like in this moment, I think is just so like WTF, like what is going on right now? But hey, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, listen, I mean, in terms of talking about culture war, you talk about Lynn Cheney and Eric Foner. I mean, I think what's interesting about now and this kind of discussion of the founding is actually we've got many different camps, right? So we have a kind of camp that is principally led by black scholars, and which includes, I would say, more progressive scholars, white or black or indigenous or whatever else, that have really embraced things like 1619. And I think are more ready to have this conversation about the founding. So in other words, they're more willing to make peace with the idea that either pro-slavery or exclusion have a role in the founding that disrupts the moral unity of American history. So there's that group of people, right? But then actually, as it were, on the other side, we don't just have like fire-breathing conservatives like Donald Trump and his, you know, White House Conference on American History types. I mean, these are people I would associate with the right and whatever else. We also have a number of scholars and writers who are more, I would say, in the political center. So these are people that I would describe as being more of the kind of liberal persuasion. And obviously, I don't want to personalize it too much, but one of them is Sean Wilentz. One of them is Gordon Wood. These other guys that signed the letter to the Times last year. And what to me is so interesting is that in the conversation about 1619, but I think also in this bigger debate about the founding, you've got this strange alliance, one that people like Wilentz and Wood might be a bit embarrassed by, between those white liberals and white conservatives. So effectively, you have those guys coming together to defend the idea of the kind of moral unity of American history versus this gang of like upstart, radical, again, principally black-led scholars, historians, journalists, who are trying to tell the story a different way. And so I think part of what's interesting about this moment is just kind of thinking about how much space there is in the culture for different stories. Like, that's what surprised me most, I guess, about some of the criticism of 1619, that you almost feel as if whether you're a white liberal or whether you're one of these white conservatives, there's a sort of danger almost in allowing this other narrative of the founding to kind of get out there. It's like it's the virus, right? It's like it could infect everyone. So there's that sense that there's a strange alliance. I mean, you know, the 1619 gang, the during Trump's impeachment lawyer cited McPherson and Wilentz, Jim McPherson and Sean Wilentz, on the floor of the Senate as evidence that the 1619 project was part of this kind of toxic culture war that Trump was defending America from. So literally you've got like Trump's defense lawyer citing white liberal historians in defense of Trump's vision of history. So I think it's, if this is a culture war, it's not a bilateral kind of two-sided culture war. It's actually, there's a conversation going on now that has different parties in different places. And it's more complicated than just a kind of left versus right thing.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Indeed. And I think like you're talking very much about like the nuance of the situation and how, and I said this, I remember I was working for the Great Smoky Mountains National Park in August of 2019 when the issues came out in the magazine, and everyone was just like scurrying to their newsstand to go get it. And I just remember, you know, doing one of my reaction video in my car in my lavender do-rag, and it was just like an amazing you know, moment. But also just thinking about, you know, I obviously, and let me just say, there are, you know, valid criticisms of the project, yada yada, so, you know, just to make sure, you know, people hear that. But I think that there is something to be said that in a world where print journalism, like the actual physical print, is really nowhere, you know, it's not really cared about as much in our culture anymore, that in this singular moment, the project did something that no other thing has done in this really generation. That's make people run to the newsstand to get something en masse like this, right? Yeah. And I think that there is a significance to that. So Nicole Hannah-Jones, Jake Silverstein, everybody at the Times, y'all, I'm sure y'all hearing this right now. Appreciate you. Good job. And also,
how do you feel?
I was going to say this before because I can already tell you this is going to be a great question. I think the other thing too is I had an inkling that 1619 would not just be an important, like, well, 2019 really, because of when it came out. I knew that the 1619 project would have bigger legs when it came out, because I also had an inkling that it would cause a kerfuffle, not only in the culture, but also in academia. And we can talk a little more about that too, but you were saying?
I think that what to me is really interesting is just thinking about 1619 as a narrative that a lot of, should we say, kind of academic, good Democrat voting historians are a little bit nervous about. I mean, again, I think it's sort of a universal truth in American historiography that this idea of U.S. history having a kind of unity, you know, in other words, you can kind of tell the story about American citizenship and belonging as a kind of single story of growth, rather than a story in which exclusion is baked in from the beginning. And there are repeated efforts to undo it. And those efforts are only partially successful. Like, I think that a huge number of liberal historians who will be today wanting Biden to win more than anything else, there's a kind of nervousness among a lot of them about this idea of having a different narrative out there for the founding. I mean, I'll tell you a story about Binder Support. I think I've told the story before, but in 2015, an extremely nice, extremely accomplished, excellent historian that I'd asked to read the manuscript got in touch with me Christmas time 2015, so just before the book came out, and said, "Hey, listen, I don't think you can use the title you're planning on using. And I said, "What's wrong with Binder Support?" He said, no, not that part, the subtitle. So the subtitle of the book is How Enlightened Americans Invented Racial Segregation. You know, the first subtitle of the book, Adam, was How the First American Liberals Invented Racial Segregation. And I'm not saying that this guy was wrong, but what he said was, you're going to get Dinesh D'Souza and Fox News and all of those guys kind of inviting you on, and you're going to become, well, this isn't an anachronism, but like the Glenn Greenwald of the historical profession. You know the way now, like, Glenn Greenwald is this guy that you can go to and get on like Tucker Carlson, and he'll talk about like Hunter Biden's laptop endlessly. And you're just watching it thinking, no, Glenn, don't talk to Tucker Carlson. What are you doing? But that was the advice I was given by this very senior historian. And on some level, I'm like, you can see I changed the title. On some level, I thought I was kind of caving a bit by doing it. But you also recognize that in having this debate between, say, the left and the center, or between these more radical and progressive black-led historians and journalists and these kind of white liberals, some of them quite aging now, that actually there is a conversation there about discourse and about narrative that isn't taking place on its own. The right in America is watching that conversation and is extremely keen to co-opt it. So, I mean, not wishing to kind of throw a bone to people like Will Entz and Gordon Wood and Jim McPherson, but, you know, those guys sincerely believe, I think, that there is a level of irresponsibility in having a scholarly or a journalistic discussion about the founding that goes to the places that 1619 goes to. And I knew that would happen because, you know, in a much, much more modest, mostly ignored way, it happened when my book came out in 2016. I think that there is a desire not to entertain those different narratives because it's like, no one's ready for that. You know, we're going to get jumped on by the right. And I don't know what to say, Adam, because I'm like, those stories should be told and they deserve a space in the culture and in the pedagogy. And if people are triggered by them, we need to get past that. We can't keep suppressing the stories.
Indeed, because I think ultimately what you're getting at is we should not be afraid of historical or historiographic conflict, because here's the thing, that's at the heart of the profession, right? So whenever someone says you're a revisionist, you know, you're writing revisionist history, I'm like, wow, thank you. Like you see me, you see me, because that is what the heck we are supposed to do, right? We're supposed to revise, you know, if there's no revisionist history, then what is Black Reconstruction? Like the biggest and best example of, you know, revisionist anti-Dunning history, Phillips history. And so I just think that, you know, you're very much getting to the heart of your book. And also, and it's an interesting way that I've been reading some of, you know, your commentary in you know, the New York Review of Books and in these various spaces. And it made me also think about, you know, Bind Us Apart and your commentary about, you know, either whether it's Will Entz or about the 1619 Project in particular. It's a great parallel, right? It's a great, you know, connection between 1619, the 1619 Project, not necessarily the date per se, but the project's overall goals and in your book, because at the end of the day, you know, like King said, sometimes it's about, you know, kind of like your white friends, right? Your white liberal friends and what they're doing, as opposed to these rabid, rabid racists, right? That are just like really just in your face with it. Because I think that 1619 Project has really opened people's eyes, you know,
Like, my mom and I have had conversations about it. And so we probably wouldn't have had conversations about, you know, the importance of the date and also how there are other dates, right? 1526, you know, a couple of dates in the 15th century. But there, you know, 1619 is an important date.
I'd also say, Adam, that, I mean, in relation to like the ability of the culture to sustain multiple narratives surrounding the founding of a nation, I do think the US has a particular kind of challenge or particular problem here. So, I mean, obviously, I live in Britain. Nobody gives a shit about when Britain was founded. I mean, like, who knows, right? Like, British history gets hung up on all kinds of things. And we have a particular blind spot, I think, regarding World War II and our kind of fetishization of World War II, which is just like insane in the culture. And I think blinds us to all kinds of things that we probably should have adjusted to in terms of our diminished place in the world. But I think the US is in a really unusual place in that I think American history, so historiography, has always somewhat been at the service of the kind of American, what should we call it, like freedom project or the kind of freedom narrative. Mm-hmm. So what you're seeing, I mean, Du Bois obviously was a kind of heretic for doing this, but what you're seeing in more recent work as well is a kind of courage on the part of particularly Black historians, because they've been the pathfinders here, but maybe more recently too on the part of Indigenous historians and others, actually to kind of look in the face of the freedom narrative and say, you do not include me. And if you don't include me, because the facts don't line up behind that, the evidence can't be, you know, amassed in a way that would make you include me, I'm going to need a new narrative. And I think that's the part of the reaction to 1619 that I have found most kind of unsettling and most unseemly. So a kind of desire on the part of mostly white historians to say that 1619 is effectively ignoring the facts and is, you know, presenting a narrative which is unhistorical, it's all ideology or whatever else. Because what it suggests to me is that at least some people in our profession, more established people in the profession, again, I'm talking mostly about older white historians now, but that they see narratives of American history as a kind of zero-sum game. It's like, there's only one in town, right? So if we don't have the freedom narrative, everything is gonna be lost. And it's like, dudes, you can have the freedom narrative. That's never gonna go away. Everything in our culture constantly reinforces it. But how about we give some praise to and some space to, you know, this disparate series of essays and artworks and reflections and, you know, creative writing, which tries to tell the story a bit differently. Like, is that what you're so afraid of? So on some level, I think when people look back on this moment in 10 or 20 or 30 years or longer, they are going to think to themselves, what was it about this challenge which so unsettled the kind of people, again, who are very happy to vote for Joe Biden? I mean, these are not Trumpistas. We're talking about people that would see themselves as being pretty liberal. So why, what is it about 1619 that really, you know, put the fear of God into them? And again, I just think it's very interesting because you can have more than one founding narrative and they are legitimate contenders for public attention, legitimate kind of contenders in terms of like looking at the facts and the evidence. That's what we do as historians, right? So why the big kerfuffle? It's to me very interesting and revealing.
And so speaking of revealing, you know, one of the things that I've been fascinating with, and I want to hear your thoughts on this. For those who don't know, what has been your major? And we're talking about Will Lentz here. What has been, I guess, your major? I don't know if critique would be the best way, but effectively, what has been your major critique with Will Lentz in terms of, you know, because I've been, like I said, been reading some of your public work. And so for the audience who might not be aware of, you know, the contestation here, what's your major quibble with, or there might be multiple, but what are your quibbles with Will Lentz's perspective in terms of 1619 and even his own book on anti-slavery constitutionalism?
Yeah, I mean, I should say, like, I mean, so he was a professor when I was in grad school at Princeton in the late 90s and early 2000s. I mean, I think I was only in one course he taught, although sometimes I sort of feel that he thinks we had a closer connection than we did, but he wasn't like my advisor or anything else. But, you know, whatever, I've got respect for him as a professor and particularly respect for him as a scholar. I mean, he's written some great books and some sort of garlanded books. I think that the sort of source of our kind of current quarrel, the one that has played out in the pages of the New York Review of Books, and I guess in the pages of the New York Times now with regard to 1619, is that since the middle of this past decade, so since about 2014, 2015, who's been engaged in this effort to write a history of the Constitution, which tries to argue for something called anti-slavery constitutionalism. Now, Adam, you're an expert on everything, so I don't have to tell you what anti-slavery constitutionalism is, but is it worth me defining it a bit for the listeners?
Yeah, if you don't mind.
Okay, I was going to ask you to paraphrase. So anyway, so anti-slavery constitutionalism, this idea that in effect, there is a project of ending slavery by invoking the US Constitution and possibly also the Declaration of Independence. So the Constitution is not, as William Lloyd Garrison said, the sort of pact with death or the covenant with hell stuff. You know, you burn the Constitution on the green because the Constitution is the problem. Instead, the Constitution could be part of the solution. And I mean, you'll recall in the 1850s, first Frederick Douglass and then particularly Abraham Lincoln mobilized this idea of the Constitution as having anti-slavery kind of power. And then, of course, look at what happens in the 1860s, certainly when it comes to the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. I mean, we do get an anti-slavery constitution, right? So in a literal sense, anti-slavery constitutionalism, you kind of have to admit that it is a real thing in American history. The big question is, when does it start? So traditionally, we have tended, through the work of people like David Waldstreicher in particular, to see anti-slavery constitutionalism as a kind of invention or as an improvisation of political abolitionists in the 1840s and the 1850s. So we've tended to see it as, you know, in the same way that you would very often hear Frederick Douglass talking in glowing terms of Abraham Lincoln, when perhaps privately he might have somewhat more circumspect views on Lincoln. You'd see it as being a kind of political project which wasn't genuinely writing the history of the 1780s and saying, hey, there's all this anti-slavery potential, but rather saying, look, what can we do with the Constitution? How can we make it work for us? Well, Lentz's book, though, so this became the book No Property in Man, which came out, I think, in 2018. So that book argues that, in effect, the founders placed anti-slavery potential in the Constitution because the Constitution very carefully ensured, so he argues, that the principle of no property in man, quote unquote, was observed in the document. So there wasn't a blanket right to turn human beings into property in the Constitution. So despite the fact the Constitution protects slavery kind of subtly and indirectly and functionally, well, this whole book is about how actually the Constitution doesn't formally guarantee your right to enslave human beings everywhere and for all time. Now, again, I mean, my reading of this is that the functional is more important than the formal. So in other words, the fact that the founders created the Constitution, which they knew would allow slavery not just to survive, but to expand, is enough. It does not matter that not everyone was enslaved in the entire United States. You make the case that the northern and southern states would never have agreed to that anyway in the 1780s, mm-hmm. because so many of the northern states were already on the pathway to abolition. But that's the big argument. So again, it's a kind of perfect exemplar of this idea of finding a kind of anti-slavery or egalitarian seed, finding racial equality or its kind of embryo in the 1770s or 1780s, and then just waiting for it to develop. So I just don't agree. I mean, we can disagree about this in a civil way and in a legitimate way. But for me, it's not the case that the anti-slavery kind of constitution has any meaning functionally, whatever meaning you might want to try and read back into it if you're Frederick Douglass in the 1850s. But Wilentz, I think, sees this as part of a project to try to argue that in all sorts of ways, the seeds of equality are not just kind of there in the founding period, but they're basically germinating. And I mean, again, I won't rehearse all of my arguments or disputes with this, but I think that's a fair construction of what he's trying to argue. And you can see some of the reasons why my general inclination towards thinking more critically about the founding era would put me on a collision course with that thesis. So.
Well done. Well done. And so thank you for wetting our beaks. We'll make sure to put in the show notes some of the actual works that we're talking about here in terms of your book, Wilentz's book, and also the stuff in the Times and the New York Review of Books. So in light of time, one of the things I wanted to touch on before we head out, you know, we've been talking a lot about history and your book and the founding just generally, but to return to you as the scholar, and you as the human and such as well, what sustain you as a what actually sustains you as a historian, scholar, and also a human in this moment?
Okay, well, I'm super lucky. I have a really nice job. I have a great family. I get a lot of support, I guess, institutionally and also kind of personally in terms of the love of the people that I love. So, I mean, I mentioned that at the start, not glibly, but just to kind of say, again, whoever's listening to this, we all find ourselves in very different situations. And I think those of us to whom a lot has been given, quite a lot should be expected. So, I mean, to the extent that this is a difficult moment for any of us to be living and working, some of us have it so much easier. So I would say that I think that those things really help a lot. I think that the community of scholars is such a funny thing. I mean, I know it sounds totally shallow and vapid, but so many people in the US that I feel able to kind of keep up with on social media, on Twitter, and also so many people I learn so much from. I mean, you know, Adam, you and your guests, you know, people that I perhaps 20 or 30 years ago would never have had the chance to encounter, but now you can feel this kind of closeness to. I don't know. I mean, I feel that there is such a kind of tightly knit and kind of well-informed and, you know, just a real kind of scholarly community. And, you know, we debate and we may disagree on some stuff, but I feel like that's one of the wonderful things about this moment, despite all the terrible stuff going on, that we have these kind of mechanisms to preserve community. I should just say one more thing, though, which is that, you know, I'm like a middle-aged white guy. And I think one thing for middle-aged white guys to reflect on when they work on race in any way is, and again, not wishing to sound pious, like there's a way in which you can kind of check in the morning and check out, right? So mm-hmm. In other words, like as a white man living in Britain, like I can do this work on, you know, the African-American freedom struggle or on colonization or, you know, on ideas of citizenship in the US. But, you know, I can go and like take the weekend off. And I mean, I think that we do still live in a society where although everything is racial, if you have a certain kind of racial privilege or identity, you can take the weekend off of race, right? I mean, maybe you go on Twitter and you like tweet about something or see something. But mm-hmm. to me, again, that just seems like it's an incredible privilege. And it's one that we should be working collectively to dismantle. But to the extent that like you have that going on in your life as well, I mean, kind of checking in to work on this stuff, but not having to deal with the levels of exhaustion and the levels of kind of frustration and despair which many of my black and brown colleagues face institutionally and in their research, right? Because if you're a black or brown historian working here in Britain, the amount of like race work, as you might call it, that they get called mm-hmm. on to do in terms of being on diversity committees or targeted hiring committees or whatever, or now investigations into slavery. Like this right. is the irony of our time, right? So we finally hire some black people and the very first thing we do is we just tie them up in a million and one investigations into slavery. So like, again, I think that those levels of exhaustion and of being put upon. Middle-aged white guy, you get to pick and choose. So, I mean, maybe that's a cynical way of approaching it, but I do think that for folks like me to kind of complain about being overburdened or whatever else would be a really bad look. So I have it very easy and I'm very lucky to have my job and I'm just really grateful every day to get to do it.
And thank you for your candor there, because, you know, I'm, you know, first of all, thank you for the compliment too. I'm, you know, I love doing new books in AFAM. You're, I think, number, when this gets published, I think you'll be number 75.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It's been an honor and a pleasure.
You're getting up there.
Yeah. It's been three years that I've been interviewing wow. folks. And it's a pleasure to do it because, you know, technology and such is such where we can have these conversations between us that get recorded and that get put out in this thing called a podcast, which I would not have known what the heck that was 15 years ago. And so mm-hmm. It's a beautiful honor to get to. As a grad student, right? You know, we talked about this offline. I'm a grad student. And the fact that I get to talk for like an hour and some change just to like, you know, talk about history and culture. And so I really appreciate you. And this would be the two last questions for you too. And you had actually alluded to this, but I want to hear a little more meat on it. What does it mean for you to write about the early United States and also the travails faced by Black and Native people during this particular period of American history?
I mean, that's a tough question to answer. I mean, I think about it a lot. I mean, I think that you're racial identity and your racial privilege matters, and it's something that you need to think through, and you need to, and that's not like an event, right? It's like a process that is ongoing and continuing. I'd say a lot of what I've done so far is to think about, principally about how white people think about Black and Indigenous and other peoples of color. So a lot of my focus in my work has had kind of white people, particularly quote unquote liberal whites, in the foreground. But yeah, I mean, the new book I'm working on has got a sort of significant and important set of Black characters. So, I mean, one has to think about authorship. One has to think about kind of who gets to tell these stories. And one thinks a lot about the people that you're reading. So, you know, I mean, if you are attempting to try and write well about the experience of Black and Indigenous people, well, you know, who are the historians out there, particularly Black and Indigenous historians, who can kind of help you along the way? So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. My next project originally was not going to be something in kind of Black history, but it's ended up being that way. But I do think a lot about that kind of question of what it means, particularly as a white person, you know, who's trying to listen and be attentive, who works on subjects that touch on Black and Indigenous history. So yeah, I think I'm still working that out, Adam.
Hey, it's all good. We're all works in progress here. And so this would be a launching pad for the next time you get asked that question, maybe.
But you're not far off to your comps exam.
Look, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. I'm actually, my next exam is actually in February on early America. And so I'm sure, you know, I'll be returning back to this interview and reading your book again for the second time to be able to answer these amazing questions about early American history broadly conceived, or in the words of the executive director of the Omaha Hunter Institute, Karen Wolf, #vast early America. So it's a great point. I love it. Mm-hmm. No, it's great. And so, you know, you mentioned this would be the last question. You mentioned this before, just then, about your next project. Can you tell us about this next project?
Yeah, okay. I'm doing three things. I'm going to tell you very quickly. Okay. So the first one is I'm editing a new Oxford History of the United States. And I'm really excited about it because it's 15 historians that we've brought together to try and write the different chapters. And we have some awesome people. So we have Tavolia Glimpf, we've got Honor Sachs, we have Sherry Randolph, we've got Joyce Chaplin, we have Nathan Connolly, we have Melinda Maynard Lowry, Chad Williams. I mean, we just have this awesome, awesome team. There's people I've left out now that are going to be really annoyed if they listen to this, but we just have a great team. And I think it's majority female. I think it's majority people of color, I think, anyway. I can't remember. But like that aspect of it, that we finally have like what I would consider a representative team to write this kind of big history of the United States for the general public. I'm just so lucky to have been asked to edit it, and I couldn't be happier with the team. And we're all going to get together for the first time on Zoom, obviously, next week. And we're hoping we're going to have a conference probably on Zoom next summer. And with any luck, that book will be out next year or the year after. So that's one thing I'm doing. I'm also writing a book about Jefferson and slavery with my buddy, Krista Dirksider at the University of Virginia. And Adam, again, this will be down your street. We're going to try and write the first book about Jefferson and slavery that tries to investigate all of Jefferson's suggested solutions to the problem of slavery. The first book on this for about 40 years. So obviously deeply influenced by folks who've worked more recently, people like Annette Gordon Reed, who's a wonderful person, and yeah, pal of mine, someone I'm very proud to call friend. Her work is obviously a huge influence. But yeah, we're just going to try and lay down all of these different ways in which Jefferson thought slavery might be ended, including colonization. And I think that exclusion is going to be at the heart of that. So that book is going to get us into a bit of trouble too, because we will be taking exclusion back into this founding space. But the thing I've just finished, the final project, is a book about Dartmoor Prison. Do you know anything about Dartmoor Prison and the War of 1812, Adam?
You want to know why? Because I watched your lecture on YouTube. I actually watched your lecture on YouTube because I actually I found through W.Jeffrey Bolster in the William & Mary Quarterly, I think in 2007, in the notes and documents page, he actually published a set of semen protection
certificates.
They were letters written by African American sailors from I think the late 1790s all the way up until the late 1810s. And because you know during the War of 1812, a number of Black sailors were impressed and actually sent to, I believe, a Dartmoor prison, if I got that correct.
That's right, which is in southwest England. So there are 6,500 Americans, again, prisoned there during the War of 1812. But what drew me to the story is that 1,000 of those are black. And when I say they're black, I'm using black with kind of quotation marks around it. So I think most of them are from the African diaspora, but they're also like a bunch of people from Latin America, from what's now Colombia, some of whom may have been black, some of whom may not have been, they may have been indigenous. They're also like people from South Asia, people from China. The reason that they got called black is because the prison ended up being segregated. So once the Americans got there, 6,500 of them, a bunch of the Americans who were white decided that they wanted the black prisoners to be in a separate space. So the book I'm writing is a history of, I think, the first racially segregated prison in American history, which happened to be in the southwest of England. And crucially, about how black people in the prison felt about the fact that they had their own prison block. So effectively, they had this space that was completely self-governing, in which they were in charge. And there's been a lot written about that prison kind of in passing in American history, but this is the first time anyone's ever written a book about it. And I just think it's fascinating, particularly since these guys are sailors. Most of them are kind of commercial sailors. They're not in the US Navy. They're from like regular merchant ships. And they wind up in this prison. And it's like, well, what matters more, race or nationality? And it's like, well, okay, are they American? Do they identify as American? Do they identify as being part of the Black Atlantic? What's going on with these guys? So it's a story about what happens to them, and to the extent that the US is really bad at helping any of the sailors. So the sailors just stuck there for years and years. It's a story about what you do when you're in a really tough situation and it doesn't look like your government is going to help you, which is why it was funny to be writing this during the pandemic.
Phew. My goodness. My goodness. Well, Nick, it has been a pleasure and an honor to finally get this interview on wax. We've done it. Oh my gosh. It's been a long time coming.
Hooray.
it's phenomenal. I'm really excited that, you know, we got this going. And actually, hold on. Let me make sure I got this right, because just before we leave, Bonnets Apart, isn't that didn't you connect that to Nina Simone in your book too?
Yeah, it's from a Nina Simone performance in Montreux in Switzerland. So she was there in Montreux at the jazz festival. I think it's in the 70s. So it's after she spent some time in Liberia. Yeah, 1976. So she's singing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free. And she accidentally mangles the words. So she should have sung Remove All the Bars That Keep Us Apart. But she's saying, break all the things that bind us apart. And this idea of bind us apart, I don't know, it just seems so kind of poetic to me, with this idea that Native Americans and African Americans are somehow going to become more like white Americans by going somewhere else. So it just seemed to me like a very, particularly since she'd been in Liberia, just an incredibly, I don't know, serendipitous phrase that I felt would be perfect for the book.
And hey, that's a great way for us to leave here. And so, y'all, we've had the amazing opportunity to talk to my friend, Dr. Nicholas Guyette. And he's the author of the amazing book published in 2016, Bind Us Apart, How Enlightened Americans Invented Racial Segregation. And as you heard in the interview, there's another interesting title that a subtitle that he originally went with. And so return back to that to get the director's cut. And so, y'all, please, if you've enjoyed this conversation, rate us and review us wherever you get your podcasts. And so, y'all, I am your host of New Books in African American Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. Until next time, y'all, over and out.